So a few announcements before the talk. One is that some people like to do what's called the 8 precepts for this retreat, which means that they don't have eat after the noon meal, so they don't have supper. And it's a traditional thing to do, and some people find it actually very helpful for their practice a number of ways. It keeps the afternoon, evening kind of simple. It's like it's complicated to go to the dining room and deal with all the stuff down there, especially as the retreat goes along and people get quieter, perhaps. And some people find it actually works better for their clarity and their concentration to be on a kind of a light stomach or not have to be digesting in that. So, and some people like the challenge. You know, maybe some people have a lot of issues around food, and so to take a meal and not have it, and then kind of work through some of the ways the mind works around food, and come to the other side and feel more at ease, or less driven, or something compulsive. So there's many reasons people do it, and but we would like that. So you're welcome to do it if you like, and you're welcome to do it for however long you want to do it for the retreat. But what you can do is you can please then sign up that you're doing it on the door to the dining room. There's a handwritten sheet there, and you can write your name. And then when you stop doing it, you can cross your name out. And then later you start, yes, add your name again. And the main reason for the... So we can have a count how many people, and if enough people are not having the evening meal, the cooks can adjust the amount of food they make. Also, the tradition is that for people who do it, they do this simple thing. There is a few things which are called the allowables that you're allowed to eat afterwards. In Burma, when I was there, we never ate anything after the noon meal. But there was this thing that we were allowed to have. There was 5 allowables, and there was this product you bought in a jar that was like a goo, like glue, or I don't know, just... And that sometimes you would mix it in hot water or something, and it was made up of oil and ghee and honey and molasses and things like that. Anyway, so there's these allowables. So we provide allowables. And so one of those things is fruit juice. Traditionally it's filtered fruit juice, and sometimes chocolate. You know, you can. That's kind of in the allowable thing. If it's dark enough, then there can't be any milk in it, supposedly. So. That's the strict rules have to do if you're a monastic, and we don't have to be. You know, we the other rule, a monastic little bit, is you accept what's offered. That takes more precedent for us. So if you're in that 8th precept person not doing supper, there might be something for you. Maybe on the side counter, the yogin eat counter. Is that where we usually go?
Usually what we have is juice. We usually put it in the white fridge, but the white fridge is super full, so we'll have to.
Okay, so you have to search. So it's mostly juice, and you have to search. You have to search for it.
Yeah, and if we do get some chocolate, it would be on the side counter marked.
So there's chocolate. It has to be. It'll be somewhere on the side counter. So, so if you want to try to keep things simple, hopefully they're simply presented. So maybe I'll say the next thing for the recording. So I want to say, so before I give the talk proper, I would like to say one word about these Dharma talks at this retreat. I don't know how they'll go this retreat, and sometimes on these retreats I'm a little surprised by how I do it. But historically, I think of them almost close to, but not really, a guided meditation. And I kind of try to bring them close to, but not to really do it, but close to being boring. The idea is that the guided meditation is that it's, as the retreat goes along, is to really stay in the flow of the practice and not. And sometimes people use the talk as entertainment. The energy of the talk is very different than the energy of how you're unfolding. And so I'd rather err on the side of keeping them quiet and not stimulating, in the hope to support you as you kind of deepen in your practice, and also maybe a little bit as a model, maybe, or an example or something of a certain way of being that's calm and steady and quiet and spacious or something like that. So one of the reasons why I usually have historically not let these talks from this retreat be publicly available, they're available by the code from people who are here, is because sometimes I talk so slow and with such long gaps that if you weren't here, you'd think that I was taking too much lithium. And so, but in the context of being here, it seems to work. People come back, so it must work. And so in some ways, I'm also practicing as I give these talks. I'm kind of, and that's one of the reasons I slow down sometimes and sometimes have gaps in this retreat, because I'm kind of trying to stay close to practicing or living close to what I'm talking about. So anyway, if you've never been on this retreat and it starts seeming different than what you have normally heard in the Dharma talk, that might explain it. So then, so I've been in circumstances where situations were like a room or something where it was dark. And hallway that was dark, cave that was dark. And I couldn't, you know, I had to find my way. And you know, maybe there were obstacles, things there I didn't know, things I didn't know. And so I'd be feeling my way. Sometimes I would, maybe I can, you know, I kind of maybe hunch down a little bit, you know, to really be low and sort of feel and, you know, be careful with my footing and try to find my way. And it's kind of fun sometimes to have all your senses kind of attentive that normally aren't being used, not needed because you can see. So tactile senses and maybe sound. And then suddenly the light goes on, and I can stand up straight. And then, there's no effort made to find my way. It's just easy, and it's quite, you know, there's between day and night, they say. You know, it's quite dramatic. And each little moment of trying to find my way with each little detail in the dark is suddenly I can look up and around, and I don't have to feel my way every little step along the way. It doesn't have to be so carefully done and so attentive. You know, suddenly I have the big picture of the room or the cave or whatever, wherever I'm at. And it just, there's a sense of ease. There's like, I can relax. I can just kind of be there in a simple, ordinary way. It's all kind of straightforward how to find my way around. So that analogy, also represents the process of waking up in doing this practice, and that's, you know, kind of the classic analogy for the direction this practice goes, is to wake up, and the assumption, the opposite of that, is to be asleep. And when people really kind of wake up, it's kind of like the light has gone on. And it's clear that before, they were kind of asleep. And the light that was off was maybe the light in the mind. The darkness was the, so, you know, often it's kind of this ways in which we get pulled into the world of thoughts and preoccupations. And still to this day, there are times when I sit down to meditate. Only when I sit down to meditate do I realize how much I've been, you know, being pushed around by my thoughts and preoccupations and the importance of things and what has to happen and what I have to figure out or this or that or something. And I sit down and that was going on. And it's so good to sit down and all that kind of begins to go be put to rest. And there's a whole different kind of relationship to things because I'm kind of waking up as opposed to being pushed around, being swirled in the world of ruminations and thoughts and agendas and all that. And I get a very different perspective on this life. And so in a variety of ways, we're waking up to what's here. We're turning on the light. And this is a very important analogy because it isn't that we're trying to change things, we're trying to see them clearly. There's a saying in this insight world that we're not trying to see something new, we're trying to see in a new way. So it isn't like we're looking for some particular fantastic thing to happen or make something go away, but we're looking to wake up to what is here and see it in a new way. And that's very different than how many people operate, where something they don't like, they want to get rid of it. And I think every meditator will do that sooner or later. That's one reference point for people getting caught up in doing that is to develop a little bit of concentration, ability to concentrate, to get calm, and it feels so good. And then sometimes I used to have physical pain, and at some point I realized that if I just got concentrated, I would kind of leave the pain behind. I would have no more pain. And so then I would just, you know, I didn't want the pain, so I was avoiding it, and I was just getting concentrated, and it works sometimes, until it didn't anymore. And then I had to finally find a new way to be with the pain. I had to wake up to it, see it in a new way, find a way of being with it that led to a certain degree of equanimity and freedom in relationship to it, rather than needing it to go away. And so I think many people, meditators, sooner or later will find some capacity like that. I can just calm down, I can concentrate, and I won't have this, whatever the issue is. And so you be careful for that. There is an alternative. And we're, you know, just in this world of insight, we're trying to wake up to what's here and find a new way to be with everything. It's a little bit like I said last night about the relationship. We're changing the relationship to what's happening. We're not trying to change what's happening, in a sense. The two aren't completely separate, right? As we wake up, what's happening will shift usually. But the emphasis is not us changing it. The emphasis is us waking up to it. And what I like also about this analogy of waking up is that, it's more saying the same thing. It doesn't imply that we have to change anything. It's like suddenly you have the big picture. Suddenly you step back and you're not enmeshed in something. And you can hold that big picture, the sky-like view of it maybe, or you can kind of... And, you know, an awareness which is awake has maybe some qualities of clarity, of openness, receptivity. It has a quality of allowing whatever's there to be there. And that allowing things to be in awareness is a characteristic of being awake. And there's degrees of awakening, so there's the degrees in which this kind of operates and how it conditions us or influences us. And so what we're doing in Vipassana and insight practice, Buddhist practice, is we're using our attentional capacities to wake up. And I use this vague term, attentional capacities, to imply to men that we have a lot of apparatuses in our system here with which we take in our experience. We have our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue. We have our tactile senses. Each of them are a different attentional capacity. We have the mind's eye, the mind's ability to know, recognize what's here. We have the mind's ability to observe, but the mind's eye rather than the physical eye, that is a little bit different than recognition, but we can observe something. We can feel from the inside. There's a somatic experience that can happen. And there's all kinds of others, proprioception and all kinds of things that are operating together, which provide information to the mind for us to understand what's happening in this world. And so some of these capacities we have are being awakened, being stimulated, being utilized for the purposes of waking up, for the purposes of developing stability and clarity in our awareness in the present moment. One of those capacities is the one that I mentioned this morning, which is knowing. We can know what's happening. And knowing, I see, is different than awareness. Some of you know that my preferred translation of sati, often translated into English as mindfulness, my preferred translation is awareness. So when the Buddha said, go to the forest, an empty hut, the root of a tree, and sit down cross-legged and establish sati to the forefront. Establish awareness here. Establish yourself in awareness. Take a stand on awareness. Be established in awareness, whatever way you want to see this. And then the awareness we have all the time. We might not always be so paying attention to the fact that we're aware because we're so concerned with some issue and more what we want to get and have. But we're using our awareness in the hunt for what we want. Or if we want to get away from something quickly, we don't like it, the awareness has to operate to help us find the door to leave. So this awareness is always here. And so whatever awareness is, I think of it as that capacity to register what's happening in this world that's pretty operating with whether or not, if you're awake, if you're not sleeping, is operating whether or not you want it to be there or whether you're trying to do it or not. And exactly how it works for every individual, I can't tell you. This world of the attentional capacities that we have, I suspect is very individual how it works for us. So for a Dharma teacher like me to say this is how it is, you have to be a little bit careful about that and take in what you're hearing and translate it to how it works for you to be present here and now with attention. And people use it different kind of ways. Many years ago at IMC, I asked the Monday night group, how do you know that you're aware? And it was kind of really, it was surprising and eye-opening for me. As for the evening, went around, people in the hall there told me how they know they're aware and the wide range of answers. I didn't know there could be so many range to that. I thought everyone was aware like I am. And it turns out that there's a different reference point for these words. So it's kind of the nature of these Dharma talks that, you know, I have to use the words and maybe I have a meaning for that word that doesn't, not quite the same as yours. It might not matter so much if your understanding of it is supporting you to wake up, to be present more fully here, to see and understand what's happening in a stronger way, in your way. And if the words I use don't work for you, you're welcome to kind of try to translate them into your way, and so that they are supportive for you. So, but here, the Buddha says, establish awareness. Establish yourself in awareness. And awareness is that which kind of can take in a lot of data, a lot of information at once, and can kind of take in the flow of experience, the river of experience that happens in the present moment. And without, you know, if we had to name everything that occurs at any given moment, we would just, it's impossible, right? We can't speak fast enough, but we take in a lot, and we kind of know it kind of wordlessly in a certain kind of way. And some people find that practicing, resting in that, and returning to that, is a very effective way of practicing things quiet and settle. For the Buddha, when he had, after he says, gives the instruction to settle, sit down and establish awareness, then he gives, in his most classic teachings on meditation, and some of the different ways in which he does it, he gives what's called the first tetrad of mindfulness of breathing. And the first thing he says, that breathing out long, one knows one breathes out long. Breathing in long, one knows. Breathing out long, one knows. Breathing in a short breath, one knows one's breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath, one knows one's breathing out a short breath. And this is so simplistic, such a simple thing, that I think that for years I would read that and I just like skim over it, like, you know, this is ridiculously simple. Like, just sit there and just know that it's long and short, and that's what this brilliant meditation is supposed to be about. And one of the things that shifted my relationship to it was two things. One was knowing the breath was long and short. And there's a number of things. One was that it's helpful to see how the breathing shifts and changes over time. A fairly common pattern is that the breathing is kind of, we sit down first to meditate, and the breathing is a little bit maybe bigger and grosser or just larger. And then as we get quieter and stiller in meditation, the breathing gets quieter and stiller, so it becomes shorter and shorter. And it's kind of useful to know that, because it's a biofeedback system that you're getting settled. So it's, that's part of the value. The other is, it helped me, was I saw it as just a shorthand. It says, whatever is happening in the present moment. And this is just an example of one of the things that could happen. And but the third thing, which is I found most fascinating, most helpful, because I was focusing on the knowing of this pedestrian thing of breathing in, breathing out. What's also equally important, maybe more important, is the knowing. We're developing our capacity to know. And so you take something very simple, like the breathing, and it's not that we're trying to become the best breather in the world. And part of this is not about the breath. The breath is just a convenient object to kind of develop and strengthen our capacity to know in the present moment. The breathing is the, for some, it can be, in this classic instruction, is the choice place to ground ourselves in the present moment through the breathing and know it. And as we begin knowing it, well, we start recognizing how we know. And now it starts getting more and more interesting, how we know something. And some people, and so, but what I do, to define knowing here in the terms I'm using, maybe hopefully like what I said this morning, Knowing is the clear recognition of some aspect of the present moment. In all the things you can be aware of, you choose something to settle on for a moment and recognize this is what's happening. And sometimes it's something very specific. It could be the whole thing. You could just say, you know, aware of it all. Recognize it all. Or like I said this morning, chaos. Or you could be, you know, something. But the idea is, take a moment to have a clear recognition of this is what's happening. This is the thing. So this is an in-breath. This is a long breath. This is a short one. So it's not being known casually. It's not being known kind of in the course of things, kind of like on the side or as a byproduct, or it isn't being known in such a way that, yes, afterwards, if someone asked you, were you breathing short or long, you say, yeah, it was short breath. So it's a higher level of knowing where you kind of stop in a certain kind of way. I don't know if that's the right analogy. Stop and just take your time. Okay, I'm going to clearly recognize this. Just like you would if you were maybe, you know, meeting different people at a gathering and you were going to greet them, you know, the respectful thing to do is to stop at each person and really stand there for a moment and really greet them. Hello. You know, some old friend of yours you haven't seen for a long time and you're in the gathering of people and then you see someone more interesting down the other side of the room. And so you see your old friend and you why? You know, you're already dashing off. When your hand goes up, you know, wave high. That's not, you know, you're aware. You're, you know, what's the problem? I practice awareness. I was aware you're there. No problem, right? Yes, it was kind of disrespectful. To be respectful, you stop for a moment. Hi. I have something else I have to do. I'll come back. Hi. As you stop. So that recognition is kind of like, oh, yes, this is happening. A moment of recognition is a moment of heightened awareness. It doesn't have to be the same thing as a mental note, which, as I said this morning too, can be kind of mechanical or like a technique that a little bit pulls us away from the experience. But it's not really so separate from mental note either. And as we learn this knowing, we learn a way of doing it that is really, really precious. So to know, I know I'm repeating myself from this morning, but if awareness is the ocean, and if you're standing in one place in the ocean, kind of, a wave, you know, not breaking, but just a wave, you know, the hump of a wave can travel across the ocean for hundreds of miles, right? So it comes in front of you. So it has a I don't know what they're called, a crest and a trough. Is that what we call the wave? And so the knowing is the crest, like it's swelled up a little bit for a moment to get the higher view of it all and something, you know, so it's like the awareness is kind of coalesced in a clear way so that there's a clarity to it. And we know, oh, this is what's happening. So if I look around this room and I decide to know something, I can see, like, you know, a lot of things I can see and I close my eyes and tell you what I saw in retrospect. But I could also go and say, that's the bell. Just really stop. Oh, the bell. How long does it take to say bell? It's probably less than a second, but it does take time. There was a beginning of recognizing bell, and there was a kind of an end of that recognition. And so that wave goes through, and to really know that you're knowing is the kind of a sense that, oh, there's this period of time that I'm really knowing. I'm not brushing off to the next thing. I'm really there for this. And then if this makes sense for you, let it fade away, that moment. So you have some sense of the spaciousness of time with it. Open time. Oh, like you had all the time in the world. Just know it. In breath. It, you know, we still might be within a second, 1.2 seconds or something. I don't know. It's a very short period of time, but it's kind of a little bit feeling of like it's intentional, it's conscious. And one of the things this is training us to do is to live a conscious life, or a life that's a little bit intentionally conscious, that's awake to what's happening. We're like in the world and we're here to know it, to feel it, to experience it. And that's where many people are asleep. They're not really here in a full quality way. They're rushing ahead or lost or, you know. And I don't know if it's how it is for you, if you spend too much looking at websites. But I sometimes have stopped looking at websites after a while. And it's strange what it does to my mind. I'm kind of spinning a little bit. And it's the mind's kind of rushing along without asking me if it could. And the momentum has been set in motion. So this idea of kind of cultivating, developing the capacity to be present, established here, and developing our capacity to clearly recognize such a way that awareness becomes stronger, or awareness becomes more heightened, or awareness becomes something we live in more fully. I like that last one. We're living in, awareness is always here, we're living it more fully. But the means to live it in more fully that the Buddha offers, one of the means, is to do this knowing practice. Some people don't like to do it because it's a little bit of effort. But sometimes what's effortless is to be distracted. And we're trying to overcome the distracted mind. We've been doing it so long that that seems, that's, it's easy. It's kind of fun sometimes even. So sometimes it does take a little work at first to know, to give time to really recognize, oh, this is what's happening, this is it. And then as we're doing that, we begin over time, it can even be almost non-intentional, but it can be intentional as well, we begin to start ironing out the rough edges or softening the rough edges to how we know. Maybe we know, maybe some people have the whack-a-mole approach to knowing. So they're like an attack or whatever they know with some kind of awareness. Some people are very hesitant. They're almost like afraid to know. It's like, that's too much somehow. Some people don't like to do any work. And so they shortchange themselves from applying themselves to the practice. Some people try too hard and they kind of bear down on what's going on and try to get in there and really, you know, we have this idea of investigating in our practice. Okay, I'm going to investigate the hell out of it. You know, really get in there. And one of the ways I've done that was kind of like the demolition approach. You know, if I just get in there and investigate, I'll just blow it to smithereens. So I've done a lot of things that I learned was not useful. So we start learning, but only by doing the knowing practice can we learn to refine it and clarify it and make it better. And then at some point we start learning some amazing things about this moment of knowing. And that is that knowing by itself has no weight. Knowing has no color. Knowing has no boundaries. You can find knowing is kind of like the moment of knowing can have kind of an expansivity to it, an openness to it. And knowing can have a contraction to it. Can be bounded and limited by the tension with which we hope we do the knowing, or the fear that's operating as we know something, or the ill will we have, the aversion we have something as we know it. All those kind of add a quality of stress, tension to the knowing. But that's added to it. The knowing by itself is kind of beautiful, kind of an amazing thing. And over time, it begins having a kind of close to effortless quality. Rather than being something that you have to keep working at doing, it becomes a little bit more like second nature to be able to know. And it feels so good to know because there's freedom in the knowing. So the word for knowing in Pali, the ancient Buddhist language, is pajapati. Pajanati. And that word is used for this, when you breathe in long, know it's long. When you breathe out long, know it's long. It's also used for knowing the different qualities, characteristics of the mind when the mind is caught up in greed, hate, and delusion. And when the mind starts being not caught up in those things, and the mind starts having a more expansive, settled, peaceful quality to it. This word is also used to know when we're having a liberating insight, when we have these insights that are really, really deeply transformative insights that releases something profound in us. That's also the word pajanati is used for that. And it's also used for after a person has had this deep release, they know they've been released. They know they're changed by it. In other words, the whole path of practice from this pedestrian knowing your long and short breaths all the way to awakening, the practice, the use, the place for knowing is always repeatedly there. And so, and I love this. Before you're enlightened, you know. As you're enlightened, know. After you're enlightened, know. Maybe the emphasis shouldn't be on before, during, and after enlightenment. Maybe the emphasis should be on the knowing. Maybe that's what's beautiful and profound and significant. To know. What do you know right now? What would be easy to know clearly? That's the salient experience for you this moment. You close your eyes and feel yourself. Then you just kind of, what's this salient thing? Oh, I know this. This is what's going on. This is what I'm experiencing. So I like to practice with the idea, which I believe is taught by the Buddha and certain texts, that the goal of practice being liberation, freedom from clinging, from grasping, is also the means to that goal. The goal is found in the means. Meaning the way we practice, we want to practice in harmony and aligned with what the goal is. So it isn't so much we're trying to look for some great enlightenment in the future. We're trying to have the knowing be in alignment with the non-clinging, the non-grasping, with the freedom, the openness. And so, but we have to start exercising our knowing to begin finding that place of ease, of calm, of equanimity, of spaciousness, of non-clinging that's possible together with a moment of knowing this. This I know right now, whatever it might be. And it's not automatic, because first we start noticing we do cling, we do resist, we do have all those things operating with us. But then we can know the clinging. Oh, look at that. I'm clinging here. And it isn't that you have to get rid of the clinging. Remember, you don't have to get rid of anything. That you have to wake up. Turn on the light. And oh. And then look for that clear moment when the, you know, the wave crests. Not just to know, not just be aware kind of that you're clinging. Not then being upset that you're clinging. But rather, this is clinging. This is an act, this is a moment of clinging. And it's in the knowing where the secret is. It's in the knowing that some, the important place is. It's not about getting rid of anything or trying to get something. But keep going. The simplicity of knowing and simple act of knowing does not need anything to be different. The knowing doesn't require anything to change. Your wisdom might decide some things to change. Maybe you have to shift your legs when you're sitting because that's enough discomfort. But the knowing doesn't have to. So wisdom and knowing might be different. So to practice this knowing. So that's the first instruction the Buddha gives for this practice. And so I would like to suggest that you do your practice, but you see if you can bring in, as much as you're inspired to, of exploring this quality of knowing. Seeing if you can find a way to know that you really appreciate the moment of knowing. That the moment of knowing seems rewarding in itself or satisfying in itself. Oh, now I know. I know this. It's how clearly you know, how fully you know, how openly you know, or how spaciously you know, or something. But you clearly know something. And you might practice with things which are easy to know. You know, if it's not clear what's going on, and what am I supposed to know here? Just know it as confused. Confused. But, you know, find things that are, you know, like maybe you're developing with your breathing, and you're starting to know some of the details of breathing or the rhythm of breathing, and there's a little moments of we just clearly know. You're standing in the meal line downstairs before supper. You could kind of be analyzing everyone's socks, judging which ones are nice and which are not. Or you could remember to practice knowing. What can you really know in the moment? And can you begin finding and appreciating something about that moment of knowing. Is there's freedom to be found in the knowing. And over time, this capacity to know and this kind of clarity can begin to snowball, can get stronger and stronger, and becomes more like a home for us. Just feels so good to live in this kind of, with the lights on, this more conscious way. And the byproduct is that the awareness, the rest of the ocean, gets fuller, more present, and it doesn't take us out of the ocean. It kind of like the awareness becomes more fuller for us. So as I'm sitting here to demonstrate, my mind was thinking about that. Is there anything more that I want to say now, and wondering? And then I stepped back and said, oh, this is considering what to say. And then considering what to say, it was kind of like my head came out of, I pulled my head out of the sand. Or my head out of the water, kind of, because I was thinking, what should I be? Should I say everything I wanted to say? And considering what I want to say. Didn't answer the question whether I should say something, but I don't have to say anything. It was nicer to kind of go, oh, considering what to say. So this is the foundation we're trying to lay for this retreat. And so, more to come as we develop this, but so see if over the next day if you can practice this way. And then tomorrow I'll introduce another attentional capacity that the Buddha emphasized next, which is the kind of the support or the corollary or the partner in the knowing. So it becomes richer still. But for now, let's stay close to the knowing. See what you learn. So thank you very much.